To find out just why NATO would want to have weapons containing depleted uranium, we turn to John Eldridge. He covers nuclear, biological, and chemical defense for Jane's Information Group. And the first question is, what exactly is depleted uranium?
It's what's left, if you like, after you've refined uranium ore and taken out the stuff that they go and make bombs with. And it's still active, but it's not anything like as active as either the ore or the uranium that's used for making weapons.
The real hot stuff, we recall, is U-235.
Yeah, that's right. So that's all taken out, and what you're left with is basically what uranium is in chemical sense. It's just a very, very heavy metal. It's a very potent material for the purpose for which these warheads being used.
And tell us why you would, in weapons design, choose to use depleted uranium, which we'll call, let's call here...
DU.
DU.
It's just that it's extremely dense, and therefore the principle of busting tank armor is that you try and pierce through it and introduce into the tank turret, or whatever, such heat on the inside of the entry hole. And what that does is break off the metal inside the tank and obviously damages the crew and the material inside the tank. And it's like a gigantic nail punch. So therefore, the harder and the denser the material that you can use, the better. And obviously, depleted uranium is very plentiful because it's a byproduct of another process and is therefore a good choice for the weapon designer to pick.
We're talking here, let's say, about a shell fired from a U.S. aircraft at a Serb tank in Kosovo, theoretically. Mm-hmm. How big a shell?
Well, the A-10 Warthog has a 30-mil shell, which is pretty big. I mean, it's bigger than your hand. But what's important is the shape of the round. And if you look at the tank round, it's shaped, as I said, like a large punch. So it pushes itself through the armor and causes the effects I've described inside.
And is there any combustion at that point?
Oh, yes. Considerable amount of white heat. Because the friction that it generates as it passes through is enormous.
And that would give off particles of DU?
Oh, yes, it would. It gets so hot that everything around it vaporizes. I think the important point to make is that it's the byproduct of the combustion that causes the problem. And the problem is not just what the press has hitched onto, which is the radioactivity of it. It's the fact that uranium is, like lead, very poisonous chemically, and that's another big problem.
If radioactivity is not the issue here, and it is simply a matter of the question of the toxicity
yes.
of heavy metals, what's your opinion about this?
Well, your weapon designers are given protocols and design targets, and they're told that their aim is to create something that's going to most effectively kill the enemy. So that said, the considerations to what happens after that have not been taken much account of. And what's happening at the moment, I think, is the fact that in peacetime operations, that kind of thing is now a very important issue for two reasons. One is that we care far more about the environment, and we begin to look more at what happens as a result of peacekeeping operation, like Kosovo, like Bosnia. And the second point is that the injuries people received in previous wars were horrendous. So you'd have people, as somebody pointed out last night, there are huge injuries from the First and the Second World War. And if you're standing next to a guy who's lost both legs and you just are feeling slightly unwell because you've got something poisonous inside you, nobody's going to listen to you. The injuries in the peacekeeping operations and the Gulf War have not been that great, for the Western nations anyway. And therefore, the proportion of those people is greater. And therefore, they have a far more impact when they point out the fact they're feeling unwell.
Mr. Eldridge, thank you for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
John Eldridge writes about nuclear defense and other issues for Jane's Information Group.